This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hey there. It's just gone by 11:30 a.m, which means that for the next half hour, we'll be filling your little ear holes with all things marine. You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio. I'm Tessa Campisi, and it's my first time back behind the mic this year. Did you miss me? I missed you. My voice is beaming to you today, as always, from the unceded lands and waters of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respect to elders past and present. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. On today's show, we'll be talking about when science communication goes wrong. We'll be back after this.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In Naam, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter. Words. Words, 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 blah, 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 blah. If you're anything like me, sometimes they just tumble out of your mouth relentlessly and it's really hard to put them back in. Trust me, I've tried. Yet the words that we choose to use, the order that we present information, the things we emphasize, and the omissions all carry significance. This is especially relevant when it comes to science communication. On today's show, I'm bringing you an interview with Dr. Gabby McCotta, who is a Senior Research Fellow in Climate Science Communication with the Climate Futures Group at the University of Tasmania. Gabby was part of a team of researchers who examined a case study of how scientific findings on the Great Barrier Reef were transformed into an instrument of climate denial in the media. Before we dig into the research, we talk a little bit about the theory of climate social science and communication. Here's Gabby.
I describe myself as a climate social scientist. So my work is primarily in climate change response from the social side of things. And that's a huge spectrum of work, from understanding what people know and think and believe about climate change. And that encompasses what we call climate literacy, so people's objective knowledge about climate change, to what influences people's beliefs about climate change. And I also look quite a lot at media coverage of climate change, given that it's such a prominent forum for the way that we discuss issues for concern, including climate change. So my background is actually as a journalist. So I've got a particular interest in the way that journalism covers climate change.
Right. Interesting. So you found your way from journalism to this kind of climate communication. What was the link there?
Well, really, I think it's the most important issue that all of us need to be focusing our attentions on right now, and particularly for journalists, given that we have that power to conduct narratives and to convey truths or mistruths. And in this time where our responses to climate change are so crucial and the time frame is so short, journalism has a really huge responsibility, and media have a huge responsibility for public understanding and action or inaction on climate change.
Yeah. So your work kind of investigates the places where climate science, public understanding, and collective discourse on climate and environmental policy intersect. And I want to unpack this term discourse a little bit. So in the social sciences, what exactly is a discourse and how are they produced?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's a very broad thing, but it can also be a narrower thing. So we kind of describe discourse as the use of language to construct and name social issues. And those social issues, of course, include issues for environmental concern. But discourse also refers to the systems of communication that shape our understanding about the world. So it's everything from everyday utterances, your conversation with your neighbor over the fence, to media systems, and so really all our ways of thinking and talking about things.
Yeah, interesting that it's both at that very large scale and then in that interpersonal scale as well, these discourses being
Exactly.
produced. So the phrase knowledge is power is a widely accepted truism, which is attributed to Francis Bacon, which in essence suggests that having access to information equips people with the capacity to make informed choices and to affect change. But the sociologist Michel Foucault sort of flipped this and proposed that the exercise of power influences what we accept as the truth, and conversely, that this knowledge that is created constantly reinforces systems of power. So I'm curious about the role that discourse plays in the interaction between knowledge and power. Would you be able to elaborate a bit on that?
Absolutely. Now, I'm really glad you brought up Foucault there because that's one of the theorists that I often work with in the work that I do more broadly on discourse. I agree with you. Those with the power to construct narratives about the world that we accept as truth really have a vast power. It gives a possibility of dominance if you are able through your ability to control discourse to guide and change and construct what people understand to be true about the world. That's huge. I've got another favorite theorist, Pierre Bourdieu, a French anthropologist, and he has this wonderful way of thinking about the power of making people see and believe. That's quoting from him. He calls it the power of creating a vision of the world, and he calls it an almost magical power which enables one to obtain the equivalent of what is obtained through force. But one obtains that through language, right? So it's this huge power, almost if one can, almost to the extent that one would obtain something through force, but instead one obtains it through language because one's able to construct the way that people see the world. So really important and really huge, which is why it's such a fascinating area to research, and particularly in relation to climate change.
Totally. And so these constructions of the world that we build through language, I think that this research that was recently published that you co-authored provides a really interesting example of these interactions. So it looks at a government report on the health of the Great Barrier Reef that was published in 2022 that inadvertently fueled some climate denialist discourses. So to set the scene, what was the state of the Great Barrier Reef's health prior to 2022?
So the Great Barrier Reef has been vulnerable to all sorts of human-caused impacts. It has been vulnerable because of agricultural runoff into the water surrounding the reef, but it's also been impacted by a series of marine heat waves, which has caused bleaching to corals in different parts of the reef to different extents over the last few decades. Coral bleaching happens when corals expel the colorful algae that's living in their tissue. Due to stress, and this is usually due to warming ocean temperatures. So this turns them white, as the name suggests. And while corals aren't immediately dead after they've bleached, they do become particularly vulnerable to disease and death. And so, if conditions improve and if the water cools down again, they are able to revive. But if repeated marine heat waves occur, then corals do eventually die, and the ecosystems that they are a central part of can die too. So we know that the Great Barrier Reef, despite its World Heritage status, has been and continues to be very, very vulnerable. One really important thing that I should add, even at the Paris Agreement goal of just 1.5 degrees centigrade heating over pre-industrial temperatures, average surface temperatures, 70 to 90% of tropical coral reefs will be lost. And if we go above 2 degrees heating, which currently looks very likely because we're on a trajectory towards 2.7 degrees heating by 2100, then 99% of tropical coral reefs will cease to exist. So it's not a good outlook for tropical coral reefs and all the vibrant ecosystems of which they are a central part. So all the species that depend on them, will be in great peril if this heating trend continues, which it looks to be doing.
So all the signs are pointing towards the Great Barrier Reef being in a really vulnerable state, especially following several of these heat wave events that you mentioned and the coral bleaching. But then in 2022, the Australian Institute of Marine Sciences released a report on the reef's condition, which was surprising. What did this report have to say?
So the Australian Institute of Marine Sciences does an annual coral survey where it takes its marine scientists and they are towed over the surface of the reef, and they do a visual survey where they look at coral growth and they estimate that. And then there's also flying over the reef, and the coral extent is measured from the air, and this is done every year. And in 2022, the AIMS published its Reef Outlook report, and what it said was that there was the greatest coral coverage in 36 years.
So, what were some of the reasons why the scientists suggested that the coral cover had increased?
Well, one of the reasons was that the couple of years prior to 2022 had been La Nina years, which means cooler conditions on that eastern coast of Australia. It meant more cloud cover, lower marine temperatures. So it seemed to be good news, highest coral coverage on the reef in 36 years. But this was mostly made up of the fast-growing genus of Acropora corals. These are fast-growing corals, as I said, but they're also very susceptible to wave damage. And they're also the preferred food of the crown of thorns starfish. And so it meant that although there was more coral growing, it was a coral that was particularly vulnerable to cyclones driven by climate change and to predation by the crown of thorns starfish. So it wasn't necessarily good news after all for the reef.
Okay, so there was this information, this new knowledge, which was cause for cautious optimism produced through the scientific method, which is one that is generally accepted as being highly rigorous and trustworthy. But as it began to enter the public discourse, you found that it began to transform. Can you tell me about how this information was presented to the media and then what you found as you traced its dissemination through the media sphere?
So the work that we did sort of had its inception in several of us who look at discourses on climate change in the media, but also marine scientists who know more about the state of the Great Barrier Reef and the species that depend on it. And we all came together and we'd heard this news about the highest coral cover on the reef in 36 years. And we ourselves saw how it had been, how it was covered on the ABC News radio that evening and how it was covered in print media the next morning. And what we saw was that this seemingly good news story led to reporting that foregrounded the high coral cover, but in many cases, neglected to caveat this with the fact that the Great Barrier Reef is still extremely vulnerable from climate change. This headline, which stemmed from a media release from AIMS, which noted the high coral cover, because it was such a positive headline, that travelled really well through media. So we saw it first in Australia and then internationally. And I fed into kind of slightly one-sided reporting in media about the state of the health of the Great Barrier Reef. And then that fed further into misinformation.
Yeah, so you mentioned that this kind of positive story carried through the media, that it sort of was widely covered. And I think that sort of brings us to news values. And as a journalist, I imagine this is something that you worked with a lot. Can you explain to me what characteristics tend to make something newsworthy and what implications this has for the communication of science?
Yeah, so news values are this almost unconscious set of rules that journalists use when they're deciding what should become news and what is worth reporting on, what is newsworthy. They've been sort of written about and researched by different theorists over the years, but most theorists agree that, and theorists have kind of lamented this fact as well, that when there's conflict and when there's novelty, then a story is more likely to become news. So certainly this story embodied novelty. It was something new. And so that made it immediately a news story, but it evolved into conflict as well, because the way that the story evolved as it traveled through the media sphere over time, it evolved into a piece of misinformation, in fact, because the story about the coral cover on the Barrier Reef was taken to show that climate science had actually been wrong about the vulnerability of the reef, and that actually it was a hoax, and that the reef was not vulnerable, and that it was recovering, and that it had this ability to recover. So the news value of novelty was certainly present in the original media release, but the story as it evolved became a story about conflict between the science of the Great Barrier Reef and those that seek to dispute the science about climate change and its impacts on the reef.
You're listening to Out of the Blue on 3CR Community Radio. Gabby McCotter there, Senior Research Fellow in Climate Communication at the University of Tasmania, outlining how scientific findings about increased coral cover in the Great Barrier Reef unwittingly provided fodder for climate denialism in the news media. I asked Gabby about how exactly the way they went about tracing this news, and she explained the research process.
So what we did is we collected news media stories in the week immediately following the release of the report. And we found the story, of course, was covered in Australia, but also in Germany, the UK, the US, and Qatar. And so we collected all the stories that were related to the release from Ames and mentioned the increase in coral growth. And we looked at the way that these stories framed the news. And we found that those that were most likely to foreground the idea of coral recovery were also least likely to include in the story remaining threats to the Great Barrier Reef and to explain how climate change was a threat to the Great Barrier Reef. So in foregrounding the supposedly positive news for the reef, they neglected to include in their story the very real and existing threats for the reef. And then we also looked at social media. How this story traveled in social media. We used what was then Twitter, which is now X, and we discovered that the story was very closely associated with climate misinformation and climate science denial as it traveled through social media.
So in the paper, some media outlets are described as central cogs in this well-established denial machine seeking to discredit anthropogenic climate change and its impacts. And it sounds that this then began to spread with its own momentum in social media. So returning to this idea of discourse that we discussed earlier on, how does the coral recovery framing of the Great Barrier Reef serve to perpetuate the established structures of power?
That's a really good and really difficult question to answer. But we know that big business, which includes media business, has an interest in maintaining the status quo, that is our fossil fueled economy, which makes, great riches for a small number of people. That's been the motivation for that, for climate science denial for a very long time. So this is really another manifestation of a very long standing trend. And we've seen it in this case in media in Australia in relation to its coverage of the Great Barrier Reef. And unfortunately, that hasn't just stayed in Australia. It's actually been an export from Australia. We saw it travel, as I said, across six different countries. And it really is fueling misinformation about very well-established science and the very well-established negative impacts of ocean warming on our wonderful World Heritage environment of the Great Barrier Reef.
Environmental reporting is frequently so bleak that it makes us kind of want to celebrate the resilience of natural systems and provide a glimmer of hope to people that the natural world can recover. And this is so vital because it's been observed that constant streams of negative news stories can make people become news avoidant and fall into apathy. So we need these glimmers of good news. But in this case, it backfired. So I'm curious about some of the recommendations that the paper put forward on how to ensure science communication is more resilient to warping and misinformation.
Yeah, it's such a good question, and it's a very difficult balance to maintain as a climate science communicator, because we know that people are motivated by hope and they want to feel their own agency to make change. But we also know that messages of, fear-inducing messages, if followed by some kind of path for action can also be effective. So it's actually a very difficult path to tread. But in terms of thinking about how media might be able to do this better, well, again, it's a very complex ecosystem. Messages are now multi-directional and there's no quick fix. But I think some of the things that we did lay out in the paper are things like the fact that communication staff in these kinds of big government research agencies, and indeed in any organization that's putting out science-based messages about climate change, they need to understand how climate news travels. They need to understand that although we all like the stickiness of the soundbite, we all like kind of the news value of the novel, we do need to steer away from sensationalism, and we need to be sort of very measured in speaking about stories that are perhaps hopeful and are about ecosystem regeneration, when on the whole, it's often bad news about climate change. We also need to think about the fact that there needs to be really adequate training and resourcing for all kinds of communicators who are working in this hybrid media system. And that includes for journalists themselves. So journalists are often very time poor. They will undertake what we sometimes call copy-paste journalism, where they take the headline and the first paragraph of a media release and they may not add too much more. They may, you know, use the quotes that are provided in a media release, and they may not then add too much more research to the piece of work that comes out of that media release because they're so time poor. So we need to give journalists covering climate and environment more resources, more training, and more time to do this really important work. And then we also need to think about the responsibility of the social media companies in policing and calling out misinformation. And we've seen that proliferate since the changes from Twitter to X, and we're losing the game of truth in social media. Absolutely. So that's something that we need to consider as well. But I think more importantly for climate communicators overall, we need to not fall into the trap of both sidism, if that makes sense. So we know that in climate change, the science is very well established, the pathways for action are very clear, the time frame is very short, and there's only really one way to frame many stories about climate change. And that is, as I've said, you know, that it's bad news, but we do have time to act and we need to act now. And sort of foregrounding stories that might distract from the action that needs to be taken and the urgency of that action are not always helpful. We really need to, you know, sort of keep on the pathway to the work that needs to be done. And communicators have a very, very important role to play in climate action.
And for the public who are now kind of participants in creating the online media world and social media, how can the public help to curtail the spread of misinformation?
Simple things like don't forward something that you are doubtful about in terms of the way it covers climate change. Make sure that you're using reputable sources like the Climate Council and the Australia Institute when you're looking at figures, numbers about climate change, and you know, speak about climate with others. Don't be part of the spiral of silence on climate change. It's really important that we all understand our role in climate action, and it's not up to someone else. It's up to all of us to act on climate change. And one of the first things we can do is become informed, right? So it's really important to be critical readers of news about climate change and to call things out when we see information that may have been well-intentioned information spiraling unintentionally into disinformation.
Thank you so much, Gabby, for coming on the show and for your really important work.
Thank you. It's been great to have this conversation with you.
That was Gabby McCutter from the University of Tasmania. If you're interested in delving a little deeper into the research we mentioned today, I'll leave a link on the show notes, which you can find at 3cr.org.au/radioblue. And you can also find links to all of our past episodes there. That's all we have time for today on Out of the Blue. Stay tuned for Out of the Pan with Sally coming up next. I will leave you with a song about realizing your friends have spiraled into conspiracy. This is Talk to Me by Skyscraper Stan. Stay salty, friends.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.